Alrighty, folks, this is Wes Dotson from the Texas Orator, and you are listening to the Texas Orator podcast, the weekly show here at the site where myself and the brightest minds from the organization get together and talk about the stories that you haven't been hearing in the news. I have got with me Matthew Cox. He is a fantastic member of the team. He does some audio. You should definitely check out his podcast, The Longhorn Update. You can find it on iOS. Matthew, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fantastic, Wes. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. With me as well is Anurag Singh. He is a recurring host of this podcast, as well as a host of Not Fake News on KVRX Thursdays at 5 p.m. If you're an Austin listener, you should tune in. If not, you can find his recorded episodes at the website and in the iOS stream. Anurag, how are you doing today?
I'm doing splendidly.
Wow, splendidly.
And that is correct because an adverb with the L-Y, because doing splendid was... Yes, continue.
Anurag is doing well by doing good today. Nick Romano with me from the Texas Orator as well. He's our foreign affairs editor. And actually, talking about foreign affairs today, Nick, you hosted a talk about promoting democracy, is that right?
Yes, that is correct. I held a coffee hour earlier today with the UT's Clement Center for National Security. It was a very interesting discussion, pretty wide-ranging, talking about the economic and political implications of American foreign policy. So it's always a good time to ramble on about things people get pretty heated over.
But it wasn't a round table discussion because the table was square, just to be clear.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, it was rectangular. So it was a rectangular table discussion.
All right.
Yeah, well, that's a great segue into things that we can ramble about that people also get mad about. We are going to be talking today about Senator Warren's new bill, the Accountable Capitalism Plan, that she put forward in the Senate. It is a plan to reform capitalism from within and give a stronger duty to corporations to consider not just shareholders, but stakeholders. With me to discuss it is are the wonderful people in the room.
Right. So who is Elizabeth Warren, the senator from Massachusetts, in case our people don't know, the people listening to this podcast don't know.
Right. So Senator Warren is a Democratic senator from Massachusetts. She is on the short list for the 2020 presidential nominations.
I would call it a long list.
Yeah.
Asterisk.
Right. She's joined by the likes of Biden and potentially others from within the Senate. She is thought to be kind of a progressive reformer, which I think she even calls herself that, but is actually in favor of markets, which is what we are going to be discussing today. She talks about capitalism as a system that is good at its core, but needs reform, and that is what she's aiming to do with this accountable capitalism bill.
Right. So Warren is, she distinguishes herself from other members of the so-called, the left part wing of the Democratic Party, like Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who call themselves socialists, when in fact Elizabeth Warren calls herself a capitalist and wants to reform capitalism. There's an interview in The Atlantic, I think it was conducted, I don't know who it conducted, I forget, but in that Elizabeth Warren articulates her positions, and she believes that this bill, the Accountable Capitalism Act, is part of her plan to reform capitalism from within. And so we'll be discussing that. And there are a number of provisions in the bill, and so we'll be discussing each of them one by one. And I hope that I didn't take away from your mojo there.
Just so listeners have a general idea. So the bill has two parts to it. One that tries to reform the internal structure of companies, as well as reform what they can and cannot do. So what would be required under the bill is that companies valued at over $1 billion in the previous taxable year would be required to apply for a federal charter under the Office of United States Corporations, which would be a new office in the Department of Commerce that this bill creates. And that, you know, body of the government would have the authority and discretion to grant those charters. And then within that charter system comes a series of rules and regulations, probably the largest and most important of which is that 40% of the board of directors of the company would have to be elected directly by the workers of the company, the employees. That is similar to a co-determination system that Germany has. And then probably least important of the bill is the political restrictions, saying that 75% of shareholders have to approve political donations. Mixed in there are some stock buyback restrictions that say, CEOs that get stock as part of their compensation plans have to hold that for at least 5 years before they can sell it. This is meant to discourage short-term price jacking, which is something that Senator Warren cites as a flaw in the market system. And then finally, the last component of it that I think is worth talking about is the... And finally, the last component that I think is worth talking about the bill is the bill as a signal of economic policy on the left, and whether or not millennial voters are motivated by economic policy, whether or not the progressive left has a cogent economic theory that they're taking into those 2020 midterms, or 2020 presidential elections, rather. And we can talk about, how we think that issue is going to play, as well as some of the broader issues with capitalism. But let's go to the first part that we talked about, that federal charter system. Arnold, could you give us a brief description of the way things are currently and the way that Senator Warren wants to change the system?
Sure. So you listed off a number of provisions there. One of the first provisions that she has, and a lot of the other positions are predicated on this premise, is the shift from granting charters from the state sector, I guess, division of the government to the federal sector. So Warren is no stranger to creating bodies of governance. She's perhaps best known for creating the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which basically regulates, as the name sounds, consumer protections for finance. And she appointed Richard Cordray to that office in, I think it was during the Obama years. And so she is inventing another body in the Department of Commerce this time to create, to grant federal charters. I think you mentioned it was called
the Office of United States Corporations.
Right. So the Office of United States Corporations. And basically the way it works right now is that corporations, the state governments, not the state, but state governments give out charters to corporations. But Warren believes that a federal charter is necessary for a number of reasons. One of the reasons she states is that it's long been, a recent development is the idea of corporate personhood. A corporation is a person, and we can get into that, but legally speaking, a corporation is considered a person under the current regime of judicial philosophy. And so Warren believes that not only do you deserve, if you're going to get the legal rights of a person, then you have to also bear the moral costs of personhood. And so there are a number of things that she's attached to this federal charter. As you mentioned, there is a cutoff of $1 billion. So right. Any company valued over more than $1 billion from the last tax year will have to apply for a federal charter and be approved through this process.
Right. So you mentioned this concept of... corporate personhood, and I think the way Warren explains it is very analogous to citizenship. So, if you're going to have that personhood and operate in the United States, this charter is essentially a granting of corporate citizenship in many respects, and therefore has or gives the government the authority to regulate those businesses,
right.
not only in their structure, but also in what they can and cannot do. And you see that in the political donations. But Nick, I want to go to you on this concept of corporate citizenship and where you see the analogies or potentially the disanalogies in corporations as people or corporations as citizens.
Disanalogies?
Well, any way you look at it, whether or not it's fair to ascribe personhood to corporations, no matter which way you fall on that issue, rights and responsibilities have to be balanced. So whether that's for individuals, whether that's for charities, or whether that's for for-profit businesses, there has to be a two-way street. That's what a social contract is. That's what all contracts are. All contracts ought to have a give and a take between both parties. Otherwise, it's not fair. So the idea of having a corporate charter, I think, is a strong step forward in realigning the kind of imbalance between corporations and government. Right now, I believe that whether you look at campaign spending, lobbying, any sort of expenditures there, the gross amounts is, it's a lot. So I think this is a strong step forward.
So what's interesting to me is that this is a very recent development about corporate personhood. I mean, the idea that a corporation is a person is so counterintuitive, to me at least. I mean, it's not a person. It's clearly not. I mean, the idea that Apple Incorporated is a person in the same way that you or I are persons under the law is just kind of ridiculous. I recall, you know, Mitt Romney, during his 2012 election, there was a big gaffe of him saying corporations are people too. And people, you know, hammered him for that. But in fact, under the current judicial philosophy and what the Supreme Court has decided, nine people in the Supreme Court have decided, is that yes, a corporation is a person, which is just astonishing to me. But if we are to assume that a corporation is a person, the distinction between the legal rights of personhood, which a corporation has entitlement to under the current philosophy, and the moral sort of responsibilities and rights, as Nick mentioned, of being a person and what it means to be a person in the society, I never understood that distinction. And so I think Warren is on the right track here in that sense.
Well, it's interesting that you bring that idea up of, you know, the history and the context of this, because I think the libertarian, you know, view of this corporate personhood is very much tied to the, you know, effect of Citizens United. In the actual instance of the case, the, you know, the claim was that this corporation couldn't fund or couldn't make this documentary because it did have a political nature. And so the, you know, libertarian view of corporations is as conglomerates of people, and you don't lose your rights when you join into an organization. The organization itself is a nominal or kind of...
So would you say that a corporation is a person in the same way that you and I are persons?
Well, so it's important to distinguish what corporations can and cannot do. You know, obviously a corporation can't like walk down the street and buy a bagel.
Yeah, of course.
Right. So it's not in that kind of metaphysical sense, but in terms of what they actually can do, I think that you don't lose your rights to act collectively in the same way that individual persons. And so when we look at the application of this to this bill, you know, the political spending component of this treats corporations as fundamentally people who don't have the same rights. And
but you, so just to be clear,
sure, like
just from terminology, a corporation is a legal fiction, which, you know, it's invented by the government. I mean, this whole idea of the LLC, the limited liability corporation, is something that a government has invented, right? The government hasn't invented you or invented me, right? The government has invented the corporation. And indeed, one of the parts of a charter for a corporation to be considered a corporation, and Warren gets into this, is the bottom line is you have to care about profit for shareholders, mm-hmm, above all, right? No human operates like that, right? No human, you know, Nick Romanow is not the same thing as Apple Incorporated, because Nick Romanow has a number of interests, including the Texas order.
Right.
So clearly there, I mean, just intuitively, I mean, the idea that, you know, that those are the same thing, I think. And I want to get other people's views on this. Maybe Matthew, you've been sort of sitting here, so why don't you?
Whether or not a corporation can be treated as a person? Well, it's weird because we don't treat them as, you know, full citizens. They're not a full person, right? The corporation can't vote, but corporations are given a voice. And as he was mentioning in the Citizens United case, it was about whether or not they could make a documentary that was of a political nature. And it makes sense that people in collective conglomerates should be able to do something like that. You know, a bunch of friends get together. Sorry about that. You know, they should be able to do their own political activities. But the question is, you know, when does it change over from just being, you know, a group of people working together to being more almost an entity on its own? Right? When it's operating and doing its own issues at the requiem of either the board or the CEO, but a vast from some of the people involved with it.
Right. And you would think that the definition of profit above all you know, profit for shareholders for the bottom line. You would think that that is sort of a separate entity from humans, right?
Well, sometimes. It also depends on whether or not that's the definition of the company. Some companies aren't defined on for profit for shareholders. Some companies are defined on very specific goals or missions, right? Technically, I think, like, for instance, I think SpaceX is defined as increasing the capacity for space travel, which is not maximizing profit necessarily. That just happens.
Well, I mean, that might be their corporate propaganda of saying we increase space travel, but on paper, SpaceX is a corporation, and the definition of a corporation is it has to care about its shareholders, right? So, yeah.
There is actually a legal distinction. I'm not sure about the case of SpaceX, but companies like Patagonia and I believe Tom, they're chartered as beneficiaries, so they legally are written to have responsibilities beyond shareholders. And so you see a lot of marketing from Patagonia about their push for sustainability. Yeah. And I guess you can question whether that's a gag or not, but it is true that there is a system in place in many states for corporations to take on a more socially aware goal.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't want to be, hogging the airwaves. I want to get other people's views on this. But just to be clear, Patagonia, I'm not sure if that's a legal thing that Patagonia does. I think they market themselves as a benefit company. I'm not sure that that is a legal charter. And, you know, Patagonia has some measures to care about other things other than shareholders. And that's ingrained in their kind of corporate sort of in their own internal corporate charter.
Right. I mean, so I want to respond to this notion that even non-benefit corporations, and Nick, we can get a response on whether that's an actual legal distinction, but even, you know, corporations in the typical sense that we think, there are market forces that do, you know, enforce a kind of shareholder value view. There are punishments for companies that act, you know, inappropriately in the way that they treat their communities, in the way that they treat their workers, in the way that they treat the value that they present in the, you know, global system, you know, so for environmental concerns and whatnot.
Could you give an example of that?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. ExxonMobil, most of the typical oil and gas companies do have to, you know, face market pressures when they have these big spills and
well, when ExxonMobil gets in trouble, ExxonMobil is getting in trouble because they violated an environmental regulation. ExxonMobil is not getting in trouble because they are, you know, they're going against their charter, right?
Yeah, I mean, even if you look at, you know, companies, and the specific example eludes me, but, you know, companies that, you know, act in ways that don't treat, you know, shareholders responsibly, the market has an operating mechanism to respond to that. And that's people can boycott, people can go to other, you know, places. And so I don't think that we are looking at corporations as having, you know, essentially competition in the realm of the way that they treat shareholders and
well, this is kind of getting
not
away
shareholders, from, sorry, stakeholders. But
yeah, I mean, this is kind of getting away from the whole thing about corporate personhood, and yeah, we'll get to Matthew, but I want to get back to the federal charter because that's what, you know, we were talking about, and what Warren's position is of moving the state charter to the federal charter. But before we do that, and I want to get Wes's views on that, we can turn to Matthew. You wanted to say something about the whole, we can table this corporate personhood.
Yeah, just real quick, is, you know, even though technically, you know, the corporation is being influenced by things outside of it, not just the internal charter, it's kind of like how a human being is, you know, when we act as persons towards each other, are also influenced by outside sources as opposed to our internal, you know, actual drives. You know, a human and all other animals, right, don't have this natural sense that says, do not steal from your friends, right? It's that's a thing that is enforced by the society around you. You know, a typical animal or person, right, has, you know, the three main instincts of eat, sleep, and then have kids. And then after that, that all comes from things you've learned or things you've experienced or people around you, right? Just like regulations would enforce this, or market forces would enforce this on a corporate person. So I do think that a corporation is more than it's just its internal charter.
Well, so, okay. So even that, I think I would have disagreements even on that. I don't think a human being is just eat, sleep, and have kids, but we can get into that some other time. But I want to move to the federal charter, obviously, because
right,
obviously we have some, to me, I don't see this as a serious piece of like a very important part of the bill, but obviously we were having some disagreements about that. Wes, you seem to think that this shift from granting the, you know, charters at the state level to the federal level will have a radically different effect on the marketplace.
Right. So. Yeah. And so the reason that I think this is because of the concentration of power in that office of the United States corporations. So when we look at the state level, it's very decentralized in terms of, you know, states can have different charter systems. States can have, you know, there are 19 states, for instance, in which companies are allowed to go beyond that fiduciary responsibility that only allows them to consider shareholder, you know, shareholder value as the bottom line. Whereas, you know, at this level, I think, you know, when we talk about the Office of the United States Corporations and its ability to grant charters, it's going to be, these are going to be the, you know, five most powerful people in the world. And it's going to be concentrated in the executive. And so when we talk, and we were having this distinction, and I think, you know, the reason that I see it as so important is because those individuals, you know, and it ties, when you look at the bill as a whole, it tries to address political corruption, crony capitalism, those, but it doesn't recognize that those five individuals that are going to be on the board are going to be susceptible to the same forces. And so when we talk about a federal charter system that has the potential to destroy a company that's valued at over $1 billion, which would be an incredible loss to, you know, thousands of people, not to mention the, you know, obviously the company itself. I'm very concerned that we're seeing the concentration of power in five people in the executive branch. And so it fits into my broader, you sure. know, concept of the executive as encroaching beyond its constitutional powers. But I think that's actually the most important part of this bill, is federalizing the charter process, because it does give that discretionary power. And so when you look down the line, when you look at, you know, progressive economic messages, I think this is an important step in that kind of road to serfdom, if you will, in the Hayekian view, that when you put business and big business solely in the hands of the executive, it's going to allow that individual to, you know, operate at you know, in ways that go way beyond our ability to, you know, have a voice in the democratic process there.
Yeah, I mean, you'd be surprised at how much we agree on that. I mean, I think the distinction we have there is that whereas you view this as sort of crony capitalism, I would, where, you know, the government is being run by the business, I would say that capitalism is inherently crony, and that, you know, the government is going to be susceptible to businesses, because that's the inevitable result of capitalism. I mean, when you have this idea that money accumulates power, then that translates to money also accumulating political power. And so, yes, I think we can agree that, yes, five people in a executive board in some government office will be susceptible to corruption because the businesses will be able to buy them out. Where I do think we disagree is that the idea that there is this distinction between, you know, the five people, you know, the five corrupt people in the government office versus the five people in the board of directors of Apple Incorporated, who are not equally as, you know, corrupt and concerned with their own personal interests. But so before we move into that, I want to talk about Delaware, which no one talks about. I mean, it's a state. It exists. I don't know anyone from Delaware. But Delaware, when we talk about state charters, Delaware has one of the most, it's when you look at business incorporation, and indeed Warren has mentioned Delaware before, Delaware is this place where state charters are given out. And to go back to what Nick was saying about companies being designated as public benefit companies, there's an official term called PBCs. And in Delaware gives out PBCs, right? And the idea is, and indeed, this is kind of what Warren is saying, is that if a company is doing something wrong, if a PBC specifically is doing something wrong and it's hurting the public interest, there will be a PBC court that will evaluate the charter and the legitimacy of the charter, and determine if the business gets the charter. Now, so that is kind of what Warren is saying, right? We want to have a court system, or we want to have some evaluating process for determining whether a charter is actually valid and legitimate and it's actually serving public interest. So what happens in Delaware, right? There is actually a lot of substantial review of PBC jurisprudence and a lot of the cases. And because of something in courts called, you know, business interests, and sort of a kind of implicitly held belief that managers are the best at controlling their own managerial positions, courts give a lot of leeway to managers. And so what ends up happening is that PBC courts don't really review any charters. In fact, the number of charters they've reviewed and the number of charters they revoked is astronomically low. So when we're talking about efficacy of this kind of thing, because of the, we have to ask, are the courts actually going to evaluate the charters? And we see in Delaware that that's not happening. And so one of the reasons I'm not so, you know, this is quite tepid for me and it's not that serious, is because courts already don't give corporations an immense leeway into how they're going to, they were going to work. I mean, if we had, in my view, if we had a functioning court system that cared about people's rights, you know, we would have gotten Jeff Bezos in court and talked to him about how he treats Amazon workers. So I do think that, you know, this is just a finicky legislative fix that won't really have that much effect. And I am rambling a bit, so I want to get some other people's views on it.
Yeah, so I just want to weigh in again on that benefit corporation. And there actually are 33 states plus DC that have this idea of a benefit corporation. And what that does is it changes the right of action for shareholders. So typically with most corporations, if you feel that the directors are not upholding their fiduciary responsibility to maximize profits, they can sue. They can sue the directors. In a B Corp, in a benefit corporation, the shareholders have a private right of action if they feel that that the corporation is violating its responsibilities, not only financially, but also socially and environmentally. So it creates a different kind of dynamic between the shareholders and the company that I think changes what a corporation is. It goes beyond just, you know, how is the government going to regulate things. It's how does the corporation's source of funding, which is shareholders, when shareholders buy shares, that funding is what makes companies run. And so by changing that dynamic there, I think that is, I think that actually will have an effect. And I believe that'll be a positive effect, because in the last 50, 60 years, the idea of the fiduciary responsibility is probably one of the worst ideas in modern economics. The idea that the only purpose of a corporation is to turn a profit to yield returns and dividends to shareholders. I think that's a fundamentally flawed idea, because a corporation has a bigger impact than just its shareholders. Mm-hmm. You know, employees, customers, its competitors, its communities, all of these different entities deserve to have recognition by corporations, especially given how big corporations have become. We can talk about antitrust law, and I think, you know, there is definitely an argument to be made that antitrust law should be enforced more than it is today. But I think right now that if there's not the political will or the judicial will to enforce antitrust law, then I think trying to mitigate some of these issues, some of these abuses by big powerful companies through greater accountability from shareholders and stakeholders, I think that is a positive step forward.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine Wes has something to say about that, but what you're saying kind of, to me, when I think about that, it also goes, going back to, I know we said we tabled the conversation of corporate personhood, but, you know, the idea of, especially when these corporations are so big, I mean, not just bigger than one state, but bigger than one nation. I mean, these are like supranational corporations. I mean, that comes back to the idea of, you know, the idea of a corporate personhood. Well, I mean, I live in Texas right now, but a corporation doesn't live anywhere. It lives in multiple places. It lives in a number of places. And so, and I think also when we get, and one of the reasons why Warren is changing it from a state level to the federal level is to combat this problem of, you know, the corporation being more than just something in the state, more than just something in a nation, right? And so to me, it just seems like one way to say, okay, well, there's no such thing as a small business anymore. Companies are just, you know, they're crossing state lines, and so we need to have a federal response. So I don't see it as, you know, this remarkable, you know, dystopian Orwellian view that I imagine that Wes shares. But let's get your
right. I mean, so my biggest concern with the federal, you know, charter system is that concentration of power that I spoke about earlier. But when we're talking about changing the shareholder value-based view that, you know, Nick spoke about as potentially one of the worst economic developments, I generally disagree, and that's because I don't think that businesses can serve a fiduciary responsibility to more than one person. Fiduciaries do need to be concentrated in one single class, and so that's why we developed a system of stocks and shares that made it very difficult to benefit one individual without benefiting another. The shares are common stock, so they cannot, you know, it's impossible to raise the price of one's one's own stock without raising the price of others, that creates an incentive structure towards that value system that provides value for all, and those stocks are available to the public. So I'm this concept that this stocks are something that only a few people have or have access to, I think is mistaken.
Well, let's get into that, because
right, I mean, so the statistic is that half or less than half of
I think it's half or more than half of Americans, none of them trade in stock. And in fact, the stock market is largely a game that rich people play. And so the idea that when we talk about stocks are for a few people, we literally mean a few people, because compared to the population of a whole, the stock market is, someone can pull it up, but more than half, I would say, I think that that's what I know, more than half of Americans don't even play the stock market game.
Right. I mean, so, that's true partly because of the deficit in savings, or the recent fact that Americans simply don't save as much as they did. And I would suggest that part of that is the social safety net that we have at old age, but we can get into that
later. Well, this is a historic thing. I mean, I don't think you saw 50 or 60 years ago people talking over the dinner table about, what stocks they owned. The stock market has always been something that a few people participate in.
Well, I mean, if you think about the composition of a 401k or really any retirement.
Sure, account, and that's a recent...
Yeah, no. I mean, and the history of retirement accounts and the composition of those is dependent on, the value of stocks. And so, people tend to start to, play in the stock market once they've established wealth. And so, I think fundamentally this notion that companies can serve a fiduciary responsibility to those shareholders while also, being allowed to consider other values such as stakeholder value, which is this concept that there are multiple people. You have to, see how it's going to affect your supplier, see how it's going to affect the community that you're established in. I think companies already do that, but giving legal access or legal avenue to bring suits under that. And we should look that, at the standing clause of this, which says that a shareholder that holds at least 5% equity in the company, 2% equity in the company, can bring a suit against the company saying that they have not considered those stakeholder interests that the bill requires them to. And so when you open those legal avenues, what you're going to see is companies enmeshed in, lawsuits that are brought by, people who, feel that they have been maligned, but would not have been in the, profit inducing consideration of the company. And so I think this is essentially a way of increasing compliance costs. And this is what we talked about, this idea of creating a $1 billion cliff, whereupon small companies, averaging 300, 400 million, the, role of innovation or the role of capital is to get those companies and make them into large, innovative companies like Google, like Facebook. So if we apply this retroactively, and this is something that Richard Epstein has talked about, is if we apply this retroactively, you look at Facebook, you look at Google, you look at Apple, if they face this, compliance cost increase at $1 billion, they're not going to get the funding required. And so I think it's both going to stifle innovation, which is the prime driver of the wellness benefits to people in a market-based economy. When we talk about wages having essentially remained stagnant, although there's mixed evidence on that.
Well, I don't know about that, but yes.
Right. So we talk about wages remaining stagnant. I mean, we're not talking about the fact that, the things that you're able to buy with that money have, increased tenfold. I mean, that's probably a hyperbole, but your access to goods and services increases over time. And so that is a function of innovation. I can generally and probably say over average that people would prefer and are made happier by an iPhone than a Nokia or what have you. And so this idea of innovation as the prime thing that should be concentrated on in a market economy is one that I hold to, and one that I think this bill imperils.
So I think we're getting into the discussion, and Matthew, you have some things, so we'll move to you first, but I think we're getting into this discussion about not specifically about the federal charter, but this overarching premise of that Warren is trying to counter against, which is what is the role of a corporation? And I think Nick and I seem to agree that it's more than just sort of profit and seeking profit for the shareholder specifically. And so there's a lot, to quote one Wes Dodson, there's a lot to unpack in what you just said. So I think let's get into it line by line. So for example, you said you already believe that you know companies have a responsibility to the community and they uphold that responsibility to communities and stakeholders. And when we talk about stakeholders, we don't just mean suppliers. We talk about the workers in that company. So stakeholders of Apple aren't just the shareholders of Apple. They're also the workers of Apple. And I guess when it comes to Amazon, for something like Amazon, it's not even just the programming people of Amazon. It's the people that actually pack the stuff. A lot of people don't realize that there are a lot of people who work for Amazon that just pack boxes, and they work in really kind of desperate conditions. But to me, when you say that, you know, Amazon and a number of these companies, these big companies, already are meeting responsibilities to communities, even intuitively, that makes no sense whatsoever, right? Because why would they care about the community as a whole if their bottom line is profit motive? I mean, like, I just don't see why a social, organically, why a corporation would be like, you know what, we need to help out the Amazon workers, you know, the board of directors, which are like five people, are gonna be like, you know, we're gonna help all the people that are packing the boxes, that are making the money that we can go off of. And so I want to move to Matthew, but there's two other things I want to talk about first.
Yeah.
Number one is access, right? So you said access. People have more access to goods and services. That doesn't mean anything. I mean, people have access to healthcare. Doesn't mean anything. Like, I have access to a number of things. Just because I have access doesn't mean anything. And number three, you say that innovation is the driving force of our economy. That, and this is going back to the wage issue. I mean, wages have been very stagnant, right? Wages have been very, very stagnant for the past 50 something years, and we saw innovation in the invention of the internet, right? So I don't agree with that premise, but yes, I've been talking for a long time. So Matthew, why don't you take it away?
Yeah, stepping back for just half a second, we keep talking as if this motivation to only work for your, you know, to improve the amount for your, you know, stockholders, to work to maximize your profits is the standard that has always been. But it's actually a really new concept. Basically, it comes from Milton Friedman, who, you know, is late 20th century. It is the idea that, you know, a company has one obligation, and that's to maximize its profits. But that's not how it's always been. Actually, Elizabeth Warren talks about this in her introductory article, where she's talking about why she's introducing this bill. And a big part of it is that, you know, there was a time in American history where that was not the case at all. I mean, even as late as, you know, the 1987, the Business Roundtable, which is a big representative group for large businesses in America, stated that a business had a responsibility for its employees and its workers and the society it was in. Actually, the words I believe used are a responsibility to, you know, to make available public quality goods, services at fair prices, earning a profit that attracts investment, and also to enhance the enterprise, providing jobs and building the economy. Right, which is a much different kind of way of thinking. It was especially popular during what one might call the big, like the good time to be in the middle class, somewhere around the, you know, from the 50s up until about the 80s, where you had, you know, you had a lot of people who had longer waging jobs. The employer was expected to take care of the employee. You had, you know, pension jobs were very popular, especially things like benefits were massive. It was often considered weird if employees were leaving a company, it was considered the employer's fault, not the employee's fault. Which has changed a bit. I mean, that was back in the day when we had a lot larger union involvement, but it has definitely changed a bit moving nowadays into our newer industries. I mean, this is a bit of the hyperbolic example, but you take something like the video game industry, the industry turnover rate for 10 years is 90%. That doesn't mean people are quitting their jobs in 10 years. That means people are quitting the industry in 10 years, right? We have moved far and vast from the period where companies used to take care of their employees. There was never a legal precedent for it. It was just the cultural precedent. But now that we've been able to somehow break the taboo of the culture precedent, you know, moving into these corporations, thanks in large part to Milton Friedman's popularization of it, since we've been able to break the cultural taboo of, you know, making sure you care for your employees, people have started to not do it when it comes to these larger corporations. I loved the example the other day is, actually, as you talk about Amazon, one of the things that Amazon has been noted for is that a lot of its lower level workers actually have to be on government benefits, right? Are in government benefit programs. Tucker Carlson, I think, put it, Yeah. Tucker Carlson put it best, I think, in saying, why on earth, you know, is Jeff Bezos the strongest, you know, the richest man on earth, and yet he still has his workers being subsidized by the American taxpayer? It's very weird that the culture we've been able to move ourselves into. So I understand the idea that we should put a legal precedent, since apparently the cultural precedent has failed.
Sure. And we'll get some other views on that. So Wes, you were saying?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's a good way of wrapping up the concept of federal charters, because that is at a national level and potentially does encourage that cultural change. One thing I want to bring into the discussion in terms of cultural change is the concept of conscious capitalism, which is this idea of Thomas Mackey, the founder of Whole Foods, who talks about business as having the capacity for conscious moral decisions and having a higher value system. And in a way, establishing that higher value system is both shareholder and stakeholder focused, because employees that feel that they are working, and this is a concept called engagement in management theory, employees that feel that they are working for a mission higher than, you know, just base profits will work better, will work more productively, will, you know, put actual discretionary effort into their task. And so you eventually get more productivity out of that. But I want to move into the next component of the bill, which does focus on those employees, and that is the requirement that the board of directors of a company be comprised of individuals that are of at least 40% of people that have been voted by or elected by the employees of the company. So this policy is essentially based off of a co-determination model that Germany, you know, has, and you know, stems back to when Winston Churchill actually lost his election and the Labour Party. So in Britain, the concept of co-determination is one where the employees had a say in who the executives were at the company and the board of directors, and Germany took that and kind of ran with it. So what we're seeing in Senator Warren's plan, like I said, at least 40% of the board has to be comprised of people elected by the employees of the company. And so that's in an effort to get the company to consider employees and their, you know, environment and their health and their wellness in the financial decisions of the company. So, Nick, I want to go to you on this, just because I think when we look at this, it's something that, you know, I see as a way of undermining the information market economy, where information and privileged information is the, you know, important element. So I want to go to you to get your thoughts on, like, how you think this is going to restructure the market of information in a substantial way.
Yeah, well, when you look at who is creating value for companies, it's not just investors. So, you know, shareholders, they, as I said before, they give up their money in exchange for equity in a company. That money is then used to make investments, pay workers, etc. I believe that workers also create value, and that they deserve a say beyond just their compensation. So not only do the day-to-day choices that companies make affect their rank-and-file workers, their workers are affecting the decisions that the board of directors makes. So I do believe that this is something that can kind of redefine the decision-making process in the board of directors, just because when they're accountable to more than just shareholders, then they have to start taking account of a plurality of interests versus, it goes back to the same fiduciary responsibility thing, that there is a multitude of sources of value for the corporation. Therefore, the corporation has a responsibility back to those value makers.
Right. So I think I agree with a lot of what Nick was saying there. I mean, first of all, to respond to your point, Wes, I don't really know what the information market is. So that seems like something. Can you just elaborate on what you mean by the information market?
So the concept behind the information market is that, you know, what is really being traded on when you see stock prices rising, falling, is actually information. Those communicate. Prices are a way of communicating information about the company. And so the way that companies, you know, work is these boards deal with highly, highly privileged information that, if shared with, you know, the employees, and if share with people who have disparate interests. You could think of a public, you know, a union contract negotiation. If 40% of a board is elected by those workers and has to then, you know, negotiate the wages of those individuals, the privileged information of the board is going to be, you know, essentially also the privileged information of the employees. And so negotiations are going to break down. We're going to see instances where, you know, people who essentially have a responsibility to someone other than the company.
Well, why do employees... Okay, so let's get into it, right? So first of all, so to back up, right, you were mentioning that this is a based off of the co-determination policy in mm-hmm. Germany. And indeed, it is true. I mean, Elizabeth Warren's plan is a far more modest version of the co-determination policy we had that's been seen in Germany. So, for example, in Germany, it's not just 40%; it's 50% of the board is made by the workers. For instance, there are workers' councils which communicate with the board of directors, and there are negotiations that have to be made anytime a company-wide decision can affect the pay of workers. And what we see from that is, you know, employees have a higher productivity. And research shows that, you know, the higher productivity and higher wages, obviously, if the labor has more of a say, there'll be more wages, increases in wages. So to go back to your point about the stock market thing, right? So first of all, again, like I mentioned before, the stock market, by and large, most the stock market is, you know, a rich person game that people play. But even if we accept that it's not, right, which I don't accept, because that's just empirically not true. If we want to get to this point about privileged information, why is an employee who's part of the company, who will be affected by the decisions in those negotiations, why is that not privileged information for them? And you do know that there's such a thing as a German stock market, and there's, you know, privileged information in German stock markets. And, you know, if employees go and do insider trading, or they go and tell everybody about some negotiation in Germany, they get in trouble. And so I don't think that, you know, the concern is that big. One of the reasons I'm talking so adamantly about this is because, you know, co-determination is a big part of the left's agenda, and we can get into this a little bit. But the whole idea of, you know, workers controlling the means of production is a big part, a component of the left. And, you know, understanding, as Nick mentioned, that, you know, investors, by and large, don't do any of the work related to profits, right? It's mostly the workers, right? The investor is just, you know, the source of revenue. They don't do anything. It's the workers creating the profits.
I would just push back on that. I do believe that shareholders do play a positive role in a corporation. They help provide, like, an IPO.
Sure, but not nearly as enough as the actual workers
for the corporation to start. And yeah, we can argue about like the relative share. But I don't think it's necessarily the point that we need to take over the means of production. It's just that the means of production needs to be cognizant of all of the factors that go into the company.
Yeah, and when it comes to the idea of losing information, you're not actually going to be losing that much privileged information, because the thing is, it's not the workers on the board, it's the workers electing people to the board. And now if the people on the board who are elected wish to divulge that would be at the their own cost. But the reason they're electing people, and it's not just some sort of like direct ballot, is so that the people who are elected to be on the board are able to deal with this information in the privacy, right? Like, just like one elects their own senators, not because you need to know everything your senator knows, just that you think you trust that these people will be able to do actions that more correlate with what you would want to see as an employee.
Right. I mean,
so the information doesn't get dropped out.
So I take that point, but I think when we're looking at individuals elected by, you know, 40% of a board elected by the employees, we're going to have to accept that companies and their employees can have interests that diverge. So we're going to have to accept that in a situation where downsizing is required, you know, that is to the disadvantage of at least some employees, you know, definitionally. And those individuals on the board could make a decision that is bad for the company but good for their representatives. So what we're getting is a board that is actually not, you know, fully towards the interests of the company. And so when that happens in business decisions, we're going to see lagging productivity, because downsizing is actually good for the economy. And okay, we need the resources that are being, you know, essentially invested in something that is less productive to go other places and be invested in something more productive. So what we see from this is that a board that doesn't have the ultimate value of the shareholders in mind is going to be making decisions that are unproductive. And when we balloon that out across the economy, I think it's going to be towards the detriment.
But that's again, why I think this plan has the elected shareholders being a minority of the board as opposed to an equal half, that they're not overpowering the decisions of the board.
So I don't even agree that that should be the case. I think that workers should have more. I mean, I think the German co-determination system is too modest by 50% because the workers do undoubtedly more work. But anyways, even if we were to get into this point, I mean, why, this is a very arbitrary distinction that you've created between the decisions of the, why is it not, for the company, like you've made this kind of silly distinction between the interests of the employees versus the interests of the company. I don't understand where that comes from. And it seems to be coming from this framework that we've been talking about of the shareholder framework. And so I don't understand. I think part of the co-determination plan is to recognize that, yes, workers are a part of the work they produce and they have an interest in the work they produce.
I mean,
in negotiations.
You can just go down the list of decisions that are company-based, not employee-based, whether to relocate a factory to either another part of the country or a different country, whether to downsize.
That's operating under the current framework, right? So that's assuming that the bottom line is shareholders.
Right, but this bill doesn't change the framework in any substantive way where those interests are no longer divergent. I mean,
by having more employee representation on the board level, you would have a shift in interest. So maybe they wouldn't think about downsizing or.
That's exactly my point. Is that those are
shift,
actual
more of a compromise.
Right, but those are actual productive.
Let's look at the world under this framework, the current framework, right? So as Matthew mentioned, and I do have some disagreements with this retelling of the history, but yes, it is true that over the past, since the 1980s, and even we can even go before that, there has been a large financialization of the economy. And, shareholders are now supreme when it comes to corporations. Now, what have we seen? Have we seen the gains that Wes and many libertarians like him talk about? No, we haven't seen that. I mean, we see the wages are stagnant. We see that people are desperate. I mean, debt is out of control.
That simply is empirically not true. Think about the basket of goods that you have available to you today. 50 years
most
ago...
Most people don't have those baskets of goods available. Not everyone can buy an iPhone.
We can get out of the iPhone.
Yeah, technically...
Microwave. Think about the time.
That's
saving.
Like saying that look at what happened. The microwave is. It's like saying that because we have the internet, we are better than we were 50 years ago.
But
of course, that's true. I mean, we a slave was in hundreds of years ago. We're better off than the slaves back then because of technology. I mean, that's not something that like is a radical thing to say.
Right. Well, I mean. But that technology is a function of an innovative marketplace that makes productive decisions. And so what I'm talking about when I'm saying divergent interest is the employee's interest is not always towards the greater productivity of the company and the greater investment of resources in productive means. And so when we create a divergent interest where a business has to consider both the means, the most productive and efficient methods and the value or the employees in terms of outside of their actual value towards production, what we get is unproductive decisions. And so what I'm saying is, in a productive marketplace is an innovative marketplace. And so this,
right.
the gains in the basket of goods that you have available to you today is a direct result of an innovative marketplace.
Right. So is it true that a person, the quality of life of an American now is going to be better than the quality of an average American now would be better than the quality of life of an American hundreds of years ago?
Oh, so, absolutely.
Yeah, okay, that's in some respects that's very true. Of course. So that's not a radical thing to say. But to observe that under the current framework we've had this exploding income inequality, I just don't think that's not.
I think we have to look at how do we define productivity, like you're saying that having a board that keeps in mind productivity, that has aligned interests makes more productive decisions. Well, what is productivity? Productivity is defined as the yield to investors, the returns on investment. And I think that that's not the only thing a company puts out. It's to consumers. It's to employees. And I think that there's actually a benefit to be had from divergent interests. If you have a group of people making decisions that all think the same way, that all have the same interests, it might be easier to achieve a singular goal. But when looking at broader, making the best decisions, I think having a diversity of interests will, because it relates to the idea of groupthink.
Yeah, I definitely agree with Nick on this one. When it comes down to it, like say, for instance, you know, take the current framework. Let's say take the system of, you know, if you have to decide on downsizing, right? If you have a completely across the board, it is controlled by corporate interest, you know, downsizing, moving to different countries, that's always, you know, always a better decision if it's going to get you more profit. But if it was, say, for instance, controlled completely by a union or completely by the workers, then the workers might never downsize, even when it would impact things like productivity and profit. But if you're able to have a compromise, you're able to kind of shift in and try to find a bit of equilibrium. You know, say for instance, if it's the workers, you know, able to represent themselves some, but the shareholders still have their own stakehold, then, you know, maybe decisions like moving out of country wouldn't be taken, but decisions like downsizing just generally would still be an option.
Right. The core, like the fundamental thing that I think my, you know, argument was trying to make is that productivity should be the end goal, and that is a good thing. And so,
but we see that under the German model, there's higher productivity amongst the employees. And a higher quality of life. You want to talk about quality of life, the German quality of life, and in many of these countries with higher levels of co-determination and more government intervention in the economy, they have a higher quality of life.
This is a federal regulation that needs to take into account the economy as a whole. It doesn't need to just take into account specific productivity amongst the workers. And so when we're looking at, you know, workers that are being productive in a factory that needs to be, you know, relocated to somewhere else, sure, they're being more productive, but that productivity is not good for the economy as a whole. And so what I'm talking about, you know, and when what the aim of federal regulation and federal policy should be is to increase the, you know, productivity of the economy as a whole,
Would you agree that on the German economy, so are you saying that the German economy and the productivity levels in Germany, I mean, we've been talking about the German surplus for a long time and the quality, and that's not even talking about the quality of life. I mean, you seem to have sort of ignored the whole, you were talking initially about the quality of life. If you want to talk about the quality of life, the German quality of life, the quality of life under Germany, under these kinds of policies for an average German is radically better than, you know, the quality of life of an average American here. And I want to go back to what Nick and Matthew were talking about, right? Productivity and defining productivity. We also should define innovation, right? Because people talk about, oh, there's a lot of innovation, right? Where does this innovation come from? And in fact, this is where I think I'm so perplexed by your position on this, Wes, because in many cases, I think Elizabeth Warren's plan will increase innovation because it gets rid of a lot of the short-term thinking that a lot of these people are thinking about. For example, the share buyback program. So what have we seen? We've seen, and this is what the Republicans were talking about when the tax bill was happening, right? They were saying, we need to cut taxes because people are going to go and invest that money back into the business. That's not what happens, and that's not what's been happening, right? That's what I'm not talking about, the financialization of the economy. People are not investing in capital goods anymore. I mean, the elite people. They're investing in share buybacks. They're investing in dividends and things of that nature. And that's partly because of the whole idea of profit above all. So they're not investing in these companies. In many cases, they're reducing the unit costs of by like shifting and going overseas, and they're increasing they're increasing their profits, right? And so that's where the inequality comes from. And so what I'm talking about is the current system right now in the United States, and less so in Germany, but it still exists in Germany, is that we see this inequality happening because of this definition of profit above all, and, you know, given to the shareholders.
Just to clarify, I think me and Nick weren't talking about productivity. We were talking about compromise between, you know,
sure,
for a better system.
And so when we talk about innovation, right? So this is also important, right? So innovation, and you're talking about the iPhone and things of that nature, right? And this is always something that no one really talks about. But a lot of the research that was done to develop the iPhone did not come from Apple Incorporated, right? It came from the public sector, because many of the long-term investments, and this is a very well-established rule, many of the long-term investments companies don't make. I mean, companies didn't make the internet, right? The internet was not invented by Bill Gates. Bill Gates came in and took the internet and made it his own thing, right? Well, Microsoft, more importantly. I think that, and we see that innovation comes a lot from the state sector, because the state has different interests than the short-term, short-minded company, right? And so a lot of the innovation that we're seeing from that, when you say that innovation comes from a productive marketplace, that's not always true. And number two, that also is predicated on the assumption that innovation only happens when people have, you know, a market interest to do it. It's not because people just want to innovate because that's actually what they want to do, right? And so, you know, researchers do research because they actually like research. You know, that's also something that's never considered in this critique.
Well, I actually have a question to pose to Wes. Like, if you feel that, you know, employees or directors voted on by employees can't be loyal to the interests of the company because it goes against the interest of the shareholder, how would you feel if maybe instead of imposing the 40% representation, instead making employees de facto shareholders by either making some policy or making some incentive for the employee to give shares to the company, to give shares to employees, therefore giving employees a stake in the board.
So that system that you're talking about already exists. Most companies that are publicly traded and have large employee bases offer discounted stock options for their employees where they can essentially buy into the company. And so, I don't see why an employee would prefer stock options to, for instance, just cold hard cash, especially, you know, the kind of employees that we seem to be most concerned about.
Make it some sort of ingrained benefit besides wages, not to replace wages, but the same way you receive a 401k or receive healthcare from your employer, you also receive a stake in the company itself.
I don't understand why people don't already agree that the employee has a stake in the company just by being an employee of the company.
When I say stake, I mean like a stake in the equity of the
right
company.
Financial stake. Yeah.
But the employee also has a financial stake. If the company goes under, they also have a financial stake. I don't understand. Can I just put a footnote in?
Just a footnote in when it comes to you know benefiting from public or private sector innovation. Like for instance, Bill Gates very arguably didn't. It wasn't the internet that he made his own thing, but it was mainframe computers and how they worked, which at the time were made by IBM and had been invented by Remington Rand, both of those being private corporations. And when it comes to the internet, that's the invention of the World Wide Web, which was invented by Tim Berners-Lee, yes, off the back of a military project, but
yes.
When it comes to the actual communication for people to be able to use between each other, right, that's Sir Tim Berners-Lee, and he just did that at college, right? That was neither
And he did it just for, because he wasn't doing it for money.
Yeah, he was just doing it for research.
Right, so that's another thing.
That's neither.
And by the way, IBM, when they invented the computer, you know, the government has backed IBM, and they were sort of considered the
IBM
buyer.
Didn't invent the computer.
Right, so
that was Babbage, then that was
yes,
Babbage,
I'm aware,
then it was
I'm aware
Turing,
that IBM didn't invent
Flowers.
The computer, but IBM popularized the computer, and part of the way that IBM did that was because the government was considered, quote, the buyer of last resort, because no one would buy a lot of these really clunky computers, so the government would come and step in and buy it. So I'm saying, that's just a footnote, but yes, we're going back to...
Yeah, innovation comes from both. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, so to address Nick's point real quickly, and then we can just broaden this conversation to talk about, you know, what the role of economic policy is in the liberal left and in younger generations specifically. But to address your point, I think that would be a contract negotiation between the employee and the employer. I mean, so employees have a marginal impact on the company in terms of an individual at an individual level. So an employee themselves can't really stop the company from going under or make it more productive. And so I don't see how the incentive structure really aligns.
But we're not even treating them as individuals. We're saying the employees as a whole get to like 40%. And labor unions are the employees as a whole.
Yes, but if you gave employees as a whole a certain portion of shares, then they would have, it would be a different way of, instead of saying, okay, the employees have to vote on 40% of the board of directors. So instead, keeping the same, having no co-determination, instead selling, or not necessarily selling, but giving shares to employees that therefore makes them a chunk of the shares.
Well, I mean, so two points to address there. One, those shares would probably face quick turnover. Those employees probably wouldn't have a strong incentive to hold on to those. I mean, that's the nature of stock markets, is they trade on information, and employees by nature have privileged information about the company and would be able to sell on that information. So without decreasing the notion of shares as a meaningful concept, you can't really do that. And then second point there.
I mean, they already do that. I mean, several companies already have, at least at the executive level, you know, shares, there's a share package and, you know, the company, right. And many, you know, the employee doesn't sell the shares because they think the company's going to do well because they're part of it. So that's also not in your calculation.
Well, I mean, so the concept that Nick is saying is they have a voice because they are shareholders, which, I mean, the shareholders all right. have a vote in that. And so, I mean, I just don't know how meaningful that would be. And it would, again,
but
it would be
about what makes employees any different than any other investor who'd be, or a board of directors. Why doesn't a board of directors sell his shares? Because the director has privilege.
I mean, the employees all have the option to do this already. So, and they could simply take their cash and turn it in. It would be a question of, are those discounted stock options, which already exist, as we've talked about? And, you know, are those stock options, essentially, you're offering something to them that they could, you know, if you just paid them the cash, they could either choose or not to choose. So you're limiting choice there. I don't see how it's a meaningful.
So I don't understand why, and we have to move on to the future of the left as a whole thing. But I don't understand why we're still on this point of shares are the only way that a company can operate. Because, for example, if the workers don't show up tomorrow, the company's not going to make any money whatsoever. Okay, so that's another way that employees have power over, you know, profit, right? So when you talk about, you know, employees don't have individual choices, that's true. That's why we talk about the labor movement and unions as a whole. And indeed, we see that when labor, and I wanted to get into this, but I don't think we have time. But there's a lot of history about when we have a stronger labor and a stronger labor market, we see higher wages for workers and a better quality of life for everybody. And so, and I wanted to get to that. So
yeah, well, I'm gonna have to let that point stand, and we're just gonna talk kind of broadly in the last segment here about the, you know, role of economics and economic policy in motivating younger generations, specifically on the left. And so what we're seeing here is, you know, Senator Elizabeth Warren certainly is probably one of the most pronounced economic thinkers in terms of the actual Democratic establishment and Democratic politicians. She's you know, harped on economics. Bernie Sanders as well. Ocasio-Cortez, to a lesser extent, tends to focus more on cultural issues. And so, you know, it's kind of neat in the way that provides, you know, Bernie Sanders is very, very focused on economic policy and economic regulation. Then you've got Warren, who's a little bit younger, focusing pretty heavily on economics with this bill, and then Ocasio-Cortez less so. So it's potentially that is a model for younger voters as a whole. And so we can, you know, see in younger voters, I think the much more motivating issues are the kind of social issues. And I want to talk about economic policy as inherently subject to, you know, the structure of our system, because your vote is so unlikely to produce change in any economic way or any economic sense. Economic policies is at a bit of a disadvantage to begin with. It's not a motivating factor because it's so distant and so, you know, intangible in terms of your vote's effect on it. And so I think what we're seeing on the left and on the right as well, but amongst younger voters, is that politicians are capturing these social issues, these kind of cultural flashpoints, and using that to motivate younger voters. So, Nick, I want to get your thoughts here on, you know, I know you do a lot of policy analysis and whatnot with foreign affairs and just in general. So do you share my kind of sense that younger voters are moving away from a policy-oriented and towards a cultural-oriented, you know, motivation?
I actually disagree with that because I just thinking about what's on my mind and a lot of what I hear from other people, it's a lot about especially college-age people. Millennials, you can argue, are a little bit older, might have different interests, but especially college-age students, I think a big question is, what are they going to be doing for the rest of their life? Is there going to be a job for them? What's their job market going to look like? How are they going to deal with their student debt? I think these are all crucial economic issues. And you can argue about vote utility and whether or not, you know, voting really is going to change that. But I do think that offering ideas about economic policy, and I think a big part of economic policy that people don't talk about, well, it's talked about
a lot, but it's not talked about as in the context of economics, is education and healthcare. Because I think looking at the way healthcare costs have risen over time, that eats a large chunk of people's wages. If you want to look at why people's, you know, real income hasn't been rising, I think that when you look at the expansion of healthcare costs, I think that's a contributing factor. So I think all these things kind of make a pretty strong argument for why the Democratic Party should focus on ideas versus identity.
Yeah, I mean, I would... Sorry, you want to go further?
Well, if you don't mind. Sure. I'm kind of concerned that... I want to really agree with you that they are concerned with how their futures are going to go. You know, they're going to want things like, are we going to get back to the period of having pensions? Are we going to have good retirement plans? But I kind of have this fear that, like, the majority of people don't really look far enough ahead to think about it and don't tend to think about things that don't necessarily directly affect them. Like, as me and Anurag had talked about the radio show, I know Mainlander talks about Puerto Rico, is because if it doesn't affect you now, a lot of people don't tend to think of it. So we have a bunch of support for policies like a $15 minimum wage or for student debt forgiveness, because those are economic factors that impact them very directly. But the things that are further along the line are, you know, how much control do I have over the company I'm a part of, are things like, you know, pension, good retirement plans. So I'm just concerned that there's not enough farsightedness here.
I think we'll when we talk about things like addressing the control of a company or a company's obligations, we're not really talking about the operations, but we're trying to fix a structure so that it's friendlier to workers, which if you're a college student, you're two, three, four years away from being a worker. That's not necessarily a long-term issue. That's pretty near term. So I do think it has an impact on voters and how people vote. If you talk about, you know, what programs, what policies are going to be in place in the next 2-3 years that are going to affect the job market, you're right about.
So yeah, so there are a lot of things. As a leftist, I have a lot to say about this issue, obviously. So you know, we have been sort of this whole thing about, like, what do young people care about? It's a lot of, like, conjecture. I mean, first of all, to respond to Matthew's point, I mean, yes, we do see strong support for minimum wage and things of that nature. I mean, 1 out of 3, or I think it's even higher, of millennials view themselves as socialists and not capitalists. That's a good sign to me. But you know, we see also, for example, this co-determination policy that we've been talking about, it really does have it's one of the most popular programs. I mean, we talk about polling, you know, people across party lines think that workers should have more of a say along the ideas of co-determination. So when we're talking about this, it has broad political support, not just stuff about minimum wage and student debt forgiveness, but things about pensions and things about co-determination. So it has a lot of broad political support, and I would argue it's had a lot of political support for a long time. And it's just that because we don't really live in a true democracy, we don't have representation of a lot of people's views. Now, when we talk about economic policy versus social policy, right? I think that that's sort of a distinction that's kind of a made up distinction, because economic policy and social policy are inextricably linked. After all, calling yourself a socialist, there is a social part of that. And so, I mean, I know we're closing out here, but the whole point of the left is, and I wanted to get into this a little bit, we don't have time for it, but the whole point about it, and I think a lot of people are waking up to this fact, especially given, you know, the situation we're in with, you know, student debt out of control, you know, the economy inequality is exploding. We have this climate crisis that there's no capitalistic market response to it. We see a lot of people saying, you know what, this is kind of screwed up. And not just because of economic concerns, but also social concerns. I mean, is it moral that, you know, because you win the genetic lottery, we don't have equality of opportunity in this country? I mean, if you're born into a rich family, you have way more opportunities. Is that a moral thing? Is it moral that people of certain races and certain groups have been screwed over for hundreds of years thanks to capitalism and how it's inextricably linked to a lot of the colonial history of this country? I mean, so that's what people are waking up to that. And I don't think, you know, people say, oh, you know, all these millennials, all they care about is just, you know, what bathroom they're able to go into, you know, or some sort of, you know, wry remark about, like, we only care about cultural issues. Those things, not only do those things matter, but they also have economic concerns. And I think you'll find that many leftists, including me, have done their homework about these sorts of things. And we see the situations going on right now. And we say, you know what, a lot of these policies, even from the so-called Democrats who have been saying they're going to fight for workers and fight for people of, you know, minorities and stuff, they see that and they say, you know what, I don't even want to deal with this system of capitalism. We recognize it as immoral. So I'm a socialist now. And I think it's a very good direction. And I'm optimistic about that. So That's that.
Yeah, I mean, and I want to just kind of close out here talking about what I was saying about the structures of our democracy and how it potentially works to favor cultural or social issues over economic policy. And so what I'm talking about there is this idea that I've written about in the past and thought a lot about is the notion of vote utility, whereupon, you know, your vote is just one in, you know, millions on the national scale, and you know, given our electoral college system, can, you know, your chances of affecting the actual outcome of the election can approximate 1 in 60 billion, which is what we saw in 2012 in Texas. And so when you, you know, look at that, when you look at a vote that is that, you know, impotent really in its ability to change outcomes, what we see is that, you know, rational thinkers, rational economic thinkers, which is, you know, the study of economics is predicated upon, will go to things that give them other types of value. So the, you know, traditional view of voters as, you know, what's going to hit my pocketbook tomorrow, I'm going to vote based on that, is I think totally nonsense. And I think it's because we don't recognize the concept of other types of value that people can derive from politics. So the tribal nature of politics has a value in and of itself in the way that it makes people feel participatory in a group, makes people feel, you know, like they are serving some higher purpose. And so I think that's what we're seeing with identity, is that, you know, the structure of a democracy is such that it allows those issues to have, you know, such power because they provide an emotional value, they provide a psychological value in their ability to create groups based on identity rather than based on, you know, we agree on some shared values and those lead us to our economic policy. And so I think I phrased it in the context of millennials and young voters specifically because I see, you know, those cultural issues, you know, those as our cultural mores change, our government and our policies is struggling to catch up. And so as that, you know, disparity widens, those cultural issues become much more flashpoint. I think immigration, more than a policy issue, is a cultural issue. And as our cultural mores surrounding that change, we're seeing it become such a flashpoint issue. And so that's where I'm saying, you know, economic policy potentially doesn't have the motivating effects. You know, that's the reason why we're covering this, is because it doesn't show up on the headlines. You know, it can be, if you walked to a random person on the street and talk to them, especially a random college student, about the Accountable Capitalism Act, the blank stares, you know, abound. So I kind of think that in terms of economic policy on the left, what we're seeing is a economic policy that is, you know, imbued with this emotionalism or this cultural significance, such that it's not on the right. And that's not, you know, a moral judgment, good or bad. But when we, you know, when you look at Elizabeth Warren talking about this bill, it's very much imbued with the notions of, you know, cultural equality, equality of opportunity, and things that, you know, don't actually seem to be reflected in the bill, at least in my estimation of it.
Right. So, I mean, I would disagree with some of what you said, and I would disagree with some of what you said. But we have to close out here because we got to get going to a debate watch party. But, you know, I do think that we do see a serious concern about economics with regards to young people. But, you know, with regards to voting, I mean, we are the Texas Order, and we care about, you know, civic engagement. But unfortunately, I mean, I would have to say I largely agree with you. I don't think voting is as important as people say it is. But I mean, I've never understood why people think that voting is, like, the only way to participate in society. There's so many other ways that we can participate and make our voices heard. I mean, we were talking about co-determination. A large part of the co-determination policy is because of a strong labor movement, and a lot of strikes were happening because the labor movement decided, you know what, I'm not going to show up to work if I don't have rights. And so that's another way we can speak and say, have our voices heard, and we don't have to, you know, be complicit in the system. Anyways, I want to thank everybody for participating. Wes, if you want to wrap up, I've said my piece, so thanks everyone, and see you later.
Yeah, guys, so this has been the Texas Order Podcast. We talked today about the Accountable Capitalism Act from Senator Warren, as well as the broader implications of economic policy on the left and its ability to motivate voters in the 2020 midterms, but you know, largely in terms of the structural nature of our democracy. You have been listening to Matthew Cox, Anurag Singh, Nick Romano, and myself, Wes Dodson. Tune in tonight to watch the Beto O'Rourke debates. I know that you're going to be listening to this after they have occurred, but we are going to be keeping a watchful eye on the debates, the content, and specifically the words that are said, because we have a game associated with it, whereupon certain words trigger certain actions that might or might not result in intoxication. So I look forward to joining y'all again next week. This has been the Texas Order Podcast. I'm your host, Wes Dotson. Goodbye and good night.